From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Detroit's two mayoral candidates meet for their only debate.
It was clear from the beginning that the mayor was irritated and that Coleman A. Young was on the attack.
The debate over Flint's long-term source of drinking water. Stay with the Great Lakes Water Authority or turn to the unconnected Karagandhi Water Authority.
And given the choices, it seems only logical that the only real stable choice that brings in treated water that does not have to be treated by the Flint plant is the Great Lakes Authority.
A U of M Dearborn female wrestler wants to compete with the men's team.
I've been wrestling guys since I was five, so through elementary school, middle school, and high school. And then when I got to college, that's when they said that you can't anymore.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The only debate between Detroit's two mayoral candidates happened last night, and yep, things got tense and testy. State Senator Coleman Young II accused incumbent Mayor Mike Duglin of corruption, of favoring big business over the struggles facing most Detroiters.
He needs to step aside and let an honest young man get the job done for all Detroiters. Go look them in the face and tell them that these neighborhoods are coming back, that you're making all these investments for them.
Mayor Duggan defended his record on these so-called neighborhood issues, pointing to improved police response times, better bus service, and saying that most Detroiters see the improvements.
I know the job's not done, but if you'll give me one more term, I'll do everything I can to build one Detroit for all of us.
Chastity Pratt-Dawsey of Bridge Magazine was one of the panelists questioning the candidates last night at the WDIV studio, and she's with us now. Chastity, you were there. How would you describe the tone of this debate?
It was clear from the beginning that the mayor was irritated and that Coleman A. Young was on the attack. So it was tense. It was sort of tense. I was surprised at how well they did stick to the time. I expected them to just, you know, barrel right over the time limits. But for the most part, they adhered to the minute and a half response time. So that, you know, gave it a little bit, with Devin Skillian moderating, gave it a little bit of structure. But, I mean, it was honestly what I kind of expected.
Now, what about content? So you've got these two sparring. While that was going on, was anything substantive revealed in terms of policy or ideas, or was it attack and defend?
You know, as reporters and journalists, and I think the public, we always hope that these debates will be, you know, two people debating on the issues, but usually they turn into two politicians trying to make the points that they want to make and answer the questions that they want to answer and win some votes. So it was the issues that have been talked about in Detroit for months: neighborhoods, crime, jobs, schools, transit. Those issues and you know, accusations of corruption against Duggan and accusations that Coleman A. Young is making a political career on his father's name and doesn't have experience. Those are issues that have been out there for a while, and we sort of expected them to be discussed, but had hoped that they would really bring new information to the table. We got a few new data points that need to be truth squatted by Bridge, but it was pretty much how debates usually go.
And it seemed that there was a lot of focusing on the two Detroits, the downtown geared to white people, the neighborhoods with longtime black residents who are largely still struggling. Where does that take us?
I mean, it makes the present bold and technicolor. Detroit is one of the poorest cities in the nation. Detroit has one of the worst unemployment rates. Detroit has one of the worst crime rates. And so, you know, those issues are really bold and bright. And what Coleman A. Young was trying to say is, you know, the 7.2 miles of downtown and midtown are not, the revitalization there is not happening for most Detroiters. You know, average Detroiter with an income of $26,000 isn't seeing as much help as downtown and midtown. And he just kept hammering and hammering away at that point. And at some point, Mike Duggan sort of went back, you know, got irritated because he's like, I am doing things in the neighborhoods. He talked about buses. He talked about lighting. But his challenge for the entire debate was to tell people, you know, I am working for, you know, his slogan, One Detroit in the Neighborhoods. And, you know, Coleman A. Young scored some points on the crime issue as well. But Mayor Duggan swatted back saying, look, you've been in the legislature for 10 years. What have you done? So, you know, it was a sparring match.
Now, Senator Young made a comment toward the end of the debate.
It is time to take back the motherland. It is time to take our freedom back. Vote for change. Vote for Coleman Young for mayor.
And Chastity, that's race criticism. He's playing the race card. He's harkening back to the old divisive politics of Detroit. But Donald Trump got himself elected using the slogan, Make America Great Again, which many interpreted to be a throwback to a more white America. Can we understand why Senator Young felt he could throw that out there? And do you think it helped or hurt his cause?
I think he was speaking to his base. You know, he's blowing the dog whistle, saying if you're poor and black in Detroit and you think that the white mayor and all these big white companies that are helping Midtown and downtown aren't helping you, then vote for me. You know, people say it harkens back to the days when there was racialism in Detroit's politics. And my issue is there's always, it's never been a time where there's not been racial. It's not like, you know, that has ever gone away. Look at Detroit. It's mostly people of color. The suburbs are mostly white people. You know, racialism and segregation has never left us. So he was dog whistling to people who might want to respond. And the other thing I do want to make clear is that the mayor was very, very careful not to talk about all of the gentrification and all of the gains and the 7.2 miles of Midtown and downtown, because he really was trying to tell people, black people, poor people, people who have, you know, not abandoned the city through all of its changes, that look, I am doing something for you. He talked about investing in $100 million or so in shopping districts and beautification. He was really trying to get that message out there as much as Coleman A. Young was trying to get the message out that he's not doing anything for the neighborhoods.
Bridge Magazine's Chastity Pratt Dossie. Chastity, thanks for sharing your experience last night on the debate panel with us.
Always a privilege to be with you.
And now to the battle happening over Flint's drinking water. Federal Judge David Lawson ordered Flint City Council to choose a long-term source of drinking water, and he scolded the council for taking so long to greenlight the city's deal with the Great Lakes Water Authority. The council punted this week. It okayed a short-term deal with the Water Authority, but the tug of war between Flint's Mayor Karen Weaver, the council, the state, and Judge Lawson continues. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here with us now. And Daniel, outsiders might look at this and go, wait a minute, wasn't Flint just begging to get back on the Great Lakes Water Authority after all the destruction that was unleashed by taking the city off that system and turning to water from the Flint River? So what's going on here?
Well, they were, and I think, frankly, that's probably their only option. But folks there are, on city council are dragging their feet, and I think because some of the threats that the mayor is making, like the city could end up in bankruptcy, I suspect are somewhat hollow, and members of council know it. The city's deal with the Great Lakes Authority, which encompasses, of course, the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department, would be a 30-year deal, number one. And number two, it would give the city of Flint credits against a deal they have with another water authority, the Karagandy Water Authority, which is a new water authority
right.
in the Genesee County area, because the city is obligated to make debt payments of about $440,000 a month to them. And so they are paying that money every month while city council keeps dragging its feet. So the mayor said this week that that's about $1.7 million that's been so far paid to Karagandy because the city council will not approve the deal.
I still don't get why the foot dragging. Is there pressure? Are council members being pressured to turn the city back toward the Karagandy Water Authority?
Probably. I mean, I think one of the stories within the story about the whole Flint water crisis is a lot of local political pressure that goes on there.
Yeah.
I don't think that this is any different. But I think you got two things going on here. Number one, the people that are really pushing the city of Flint to do this.
To do what? To go to KWA?
To go to Great Lakes. There's all these names. To go to Great Lakes is the state of Michigan. And so naturally in Flint, there is suspicion of anything that the state is trying to push them to do. And I think that's one thing. Second thing is, I think some people have said, they've been quoted as saying, you know, I don't really like a 30-year deal. Maybe we could do a shorter term. That obligates us for a very, very long time. Now, as I point out in today's column, I think yeah, you could probably try to renegotiate it, but will you get the same kind of terms? Would the Great Lakes give them credits for the full debt payments to Karagandhi that they have to pay over what I think they're obligated at least over the next 20 years? The answer is probably no. I mean, long-term deals to utilities are very important. It helps them map out their rates. It helps them match out their capital spending, their investment on the system, all those kinds of things. And Flint is a very important piece of the Great Lakes. It's a big customer, so it's a very important piece of the overall system for the Great Lakes. So I think that's one of the reasons they would do it. But, you know, the suspicion in Flint among all this stuff, I think, is very natural. The other thing I would say is, if you're a resident and you're back on Detroit water again with under the Great Lakes authority, how are you going to react if all of a sudden the city council says, you know what, we've changed our minds, we're going to go back with this other group.
Right.
And oh, by the way, they don't treat the water. We have to treat the water in our plant that has not been treating water for 50 years.
This all sounds suspiciously like echoes of what began back in 2014.
Exactly.
When, yes.
Exactly. And I've interviewed the mayor and talked to her about this several times, and she's pointed out, and I think she's right, we need to reassure people and we need to have a stable source here. And given the choices, it seems only logical that the only real stable choice that brings in treated water that does not have to be treated by the Flint plant is the Great Lakes Authority.
Meantime, you've got federal Judge Lawson. He's had to be cracking the whip all along here. He was, you know, shoving at the state of Michigan for slowing down on delivering bottled water. Mm-hmm. Now he's got to kind of crack the whip with city council. It's just interesting that there has to be so much hurting along the path.
Well, I think there's so much mistrust here. And, you know, I think the federal authority here is about the only authority that's going to move this process along. Mm. Now, I do think that, you know, a bankruptcy filing for the city of Flint could have some salutary effects, but I really seriously doubt that Governor Rick Snyder in his last year in office would greenlight a bankruptcy filing of the state's second largest minority-majority city.
Choppy waters in Flint for sure. Detroit News Business columnist Daniel Howes. As always, Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
She wants to wrestle with the University of Michigan Dearborn men's team, but the rule book, she says, keeps her off the mat.
I've been wrestling guys since I was five, so through elementary school, middle school, and high school. And then when I got to college, that's when they said, you can't anymore.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. One of President Trump's big campaign promises, as we know, was to rewrite NAFTA to be a better deal for the United States, or he said he would scrap the trade pact with Mexico and Canada. And talks are happening right now to renegotiate the North American Free Trade Act. My next guest wants to make sure that Michigan agriculture is protected whatever happens to NAFTA. Jamie Clover Adams is director of the Michigan Department of Agriculture and Rural Development. Jamie, welcome.
Great to be here.
And it is worth noting, agriculture really is in your blood. You are a farm girl from Ionia County.
Absolutely. I was maybe one of the black sheep. I went to the University of Michigan for school, but grew up on a small Angus farm here in Ionia County.
So tell us, how crucial, Jamie, is NAFTA to the success of Michigan agriculture?
It's absolutely vital. If you look at the data, it makes up about 38% of the exports that we have, $2.8 billion annually, and that supports about 26,000 jobs. If we take cattle, for example, what I grew up with, trade, not just NAFTA, but trade, makes up about $350 a head on colored cattle. If we didn't have trade, even though Michigan cattle don't always go into trade, those prices would drop for Michigan farmers. So trade is just really important for prices.
If indeed President Trump winds up following through on that promise to blow up NAFTA, if he doesn't think that America is getting a good deal, what would blowing up that deal mean for Michigan farmers and growers?
On the Mexican side right now, NAFTA means that there are no tariffs on anything going into Mexico or coming from Mexico into the U.S. We would revert, as I understand it, back to the tariffs that existed 24, 25 years ago before NAFTA was put in place. With Canada, I would assume that it would be the same, although trade isn't as free, particularly in the dairy sector, into Canada. But, you know, I really don't think it's going to get to that. You know, the president is correct that NAFTA needs to be modernized. I kind of chuckled this one into effect the year that I was married, and I know that a lot of things have changed since then. And there are things that we do need to work on and modernize, and I think he understands the importance of trade to agriculture.
Last week, I know you attended the 26th Tri-National Agricultural Accord in Denver, a four-day summit that brought together state and federal and provincial officials from the U.S., Canada, and Mexico to talk all things agriculture, opportunities, trade, and rural development. Tell me, what was the tenor in the room at the summit?
Well, you know, I think it was interesting. I did notice a difference this year. I've been to, I think this is my fourth or fifth one that I've been to since I've been director, and it was different. And I think the difference was, normally we get together and we talk about the irritants, because that's what we focus on. You know, how can we work better as regulatory agencies on, you know, dairy products coming across the border with Canada, or, you know, fever ticks on cattle with Mexico. This time around, I think the fact that NAFTA is being renegotiated, we all step back and we reassess the importance of the relationship between the three countries. And we did talk a lot about how being a trading bloc, having an integrated economy and integrated supply chain helps us be stronger in the world economy. We've seen trading blocks arise around the world, and we need to be a part of one as well to help our farmers and ranchers be competitive.
What were some of the top worries or concerns that you heard amongst the agriculture leaders from these three countries?
Well, I think particularly from Canada and Mexico was just what you discussed earlier, was that the whole agreement would be scrapped. We spent a lot of time on the U.S. side, you know, making sure that our neighbors understood that we valued the partnerships we had with them. We value the relationships that we have with them. And we understand that agriculture is an integrated system across both the northern and the southern borders, and that we had just as much to lose as they did, and that we would work just as hard as they did to make sure that, you know, we lift up all farmers and ranchers and rural communities across the three countries.
Would you say there was more division or more agreement among the officials attending this accord?
More agreement. It's kind of funny, you know, in agriculture here in the U.S., regardless of party, we all see things pretty much the same way. We have a lot more in common than we have differences, and I think it is the same across the borders as well. You know, they're concerned about their producers and their rural communities, as are we. And the issues that we work on are how to make that trade flow more easily. How is it that, you know, states and provinces can bring ideas to the table? You know, that's the one thing we did talk about, is we'd like to see in the NAFTA agreement that in the future, people in our positions are part of the negotiation. You know, states and provinces are the laboratories of ideas, and we are problem-solving people because we work on the ground all the time, and it would be good for the people that are negotiating to understand how to solve problems.
If you just joined us, I'm talking with Jamie Clover Adams, who directs the Michigan Department of Agriculture and Rural Development, as we explore the talks going on right now to renegotiate the North American Free Trade Act, NAFTA, and what that might mean to agriculture in Michigan. One of President Trump's signature campaign messages was also that he was going to build that wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. There are some prototypes going up that he's going to go inspect. But what was the talk at that conference you were at about the wall?
Actually, that didn't even come up. We did have discussions about ag labor. That's a problem in all three of our countries, you know, having enough people, particularly to pick hand-harvested crops. And, you know, while folks from the city may see that as manual labor, it really is very high-skilled labor. I often laugh. If I got hired to pick blueberries, I'd probably be fired the first day because I would never be able to keep up with some of these guys and how good they are at what they do. And I was frankly surprised that in Mexico, they are facing many of the same issues that we are, finding labor, to harvest hand-harvested crops. And then we also see issues in our, you know, egg facilities, in our dairy facilities in particular. So we spend our time talking more about how do we share labor as opposed to, like I said, the wall never came up.
If the wall would be built, how do you see it affecting Michigan farmers, if at all?
Well, I think we're already seeing the impacts, even though it's not built. You know, we're at the end of the pipeline. That's the first thing to keep in mind, that migrants that come from Texas and Florida, they follow the maturing of the crop, so we're at the end. We have seen people hunker down where they are, and they're not coming back because perhaps they have one or two undocumented folks in their party and they don't want to risk it. We have seen countrywide, I think I saw data, we're at, I think, 200,000 H-2A workers. We've seen a significant increase in H-2A workers, and that's the legal guest worker program. It's very clunky and very old, but farmers are turning to that to ensure that they have labor to pick their crops.
We have certainly spoken with a lot of farmers and growers on this program about their concerns of hands to do the work. NAFTA is a highly complex trade agreement, a lot of moving parts, and a lot subject to change. What part or parts of NAFTA do you worry most about being changed or scrapped?
We're concerned that we protect the gains that we've made. That's the first thing. So we want to make sure that we don't erect any tariffs, for example, with Mexico, because it's tariff-free back and forth across the border. We'd like to keep that. We would like to see gains in sanitary and phytosanitary, for example. We don't want a backslide. We want science to drive what goes in and out of countries. And, you know, an example, again, with Mexico, it doesn't affect Michigan, but, you know, there's some issues with table potatoes going into Mexico. They can only go within 26 miles of the border because of supposed pest issues. But there really is no science behind that. And so we'd like to see some gains in that area. With Canada, we have a lot more in common in our systems, but, you know, they do have quotas on dairy products that can go into Canada, and we'd like to see a little more opportunity for our farmers and co-ops and businesses to be able to compete for Canadian business. So we don't want to see any backsliding on that. There is some concern about proposals that would allow more regional ways to look at dumping, particularly in the southeast part of our country. I think that would have a detrimental impact on some of our fruit and vegetable products because we don't compete head-to-head with what comes in from Mexico because, again, of the weather, you know, when the crops mature, where, you know, some of the stuff coming in from Mexico, particularly tomatoes, competes head-to-head with Georgia and Florida. So that one's a little more concerning, but I'm sure that they'll figure out how to get what both sides need, and that's what we need to do, is look at how can both sides win.
What do you say to many of these voters in these communities who said yes to Donald Trump and they liked what he said about we'll throw it out if it's not a better deal for the U.S., but yet they could be even further affected if that trade deal is scrapped?
What I would like to say to them is let's get together. I mean, the other thing I talked about at the Tri-National Accord in Denver was with our Canadian counterparts particularly is Governor Schneider's initiative to get people into the skilled trades. I think in the world that we live in today, you know, and I have a soon-to-be 21-year-old, and her world is going to be very different than mine was, and I think the best thing that we can do for people and the best thing we can do particularly for rural communities is make sure that people have the skill sets that they need to be competitive in today's market. The governor talks all the time about, you know, the numbers of jobs that are available in Michigan that go unfilled. And that's where I would point people. Rather than trying to find somebody to blame, let's all work together and help lift people up and help them get the training that they need and continue to learn. I think that's the other thing about the future is we're going to have to be lifelong learners. You know, I spoke to a group of kids over at MSU in the Animal Science Club, and I just said, you know, when you get your degree from here, that's not the end, it's the beginning.
Jamie Clover Adams, Director of the Michigan Department of Agriculture and Rural Development. Jamie, thank you so much for your time on Stateside today.
Great. It was good to be here.
Creation.
Entrepreneurship.
The next idea.
We have to make room for this ability to learn to be creative.
Scientists have known for a while America's bee population is in trouble. Some types are even ending up on the endangered species list. Pollinator insects like bees are critical to food production, and in agricultural states like Michigan, keeping that population alive and healthy is a really big deal. A small but colorful pilot project at the Michigan Department of Transportation aims to provide some late-season meals for those hardworking bees. Our guest on The Next Idea today is with MDOT's Bay Region, where plantings of sunflowers have been brightening areas near freeways. Jocelyn Hull, welcome to The Next Idea.
Oh, thank you.
So we're talking, Jocelyn, about right-of-way sunflower plantings, which means what exactly when we say right-of-way?
So what right-of-way sunflower planting is, that's within the area that the state of Michigan owns along all of our state trunk lines. So any MI or US route, we own a certain portion of land directly adjacent to the road and shoulder. That's our right-of-way.
So you started this program last year. It was a pilot season planting an area of sunflowers near I-75 in Saginaw County. And I understand that your news about that pilot season was particularly timely.
Yeah, it was incredibly timely. We issued a press release discussing the success of that planting on a Monday. The weekend prior to that release date, there were actually, I believe, six additional species of honeybees that were added to the endangered list. So the timing was incredibly crucial to really send home the message that this was something that was important that we were doing. It wasn't just something fun and colorful. It really provides a purpose.
Yeah, explain to us why sunflowers were a good choice for this, for both being alongside a freeway and also for the bees.
Okay, so there's a couple different reasons that we chose to use sunflowers on our pilot. Sunflowers are known to be an incredibly hardy plant. So they are able to grow and thrive in less ideal soil settings. So the interchange that we first planted in, it's seen a lot of construction and reconstruction over the years. It's been around for a long time, and it actually is an upcoming reconstruction project in 2020. So this interchange doesn't have the most ideal soil composition anymore at this point. And additional plantings that we had tried there hadn't been successful. So we decided to try these sunflowers. They not only grew really, really well, but they were also a really popular food source for honeybees. So last year, we planted those flowers in the summertime. They bloomed really heavy at the end of August, and that's when a lot of food sources tend to kind of taper off in Michigan as the temperature starts to change. So they provided a really popular food source for all those honeybees.
So did you add more planting areas this year for the second year?
We did, actually. It was successful in our initial rollout site last year, so we added two additional planting sites this year, one in Bay County and one in Isabella County, and those both grew really successfully as well.
So is MDOT looking at perhaps expanding this idea to other right-of-way areas around the state? Could we be seeing sunflowers brightening our drives all through Michigan?
I think it's definitely possible to see some kind of flower planting, some kind of popular pollinating support planting statewide. That's something that we're very passionate about, and we plan to continue expanding those kind of opportunities. You know, sunflowers were something that we wanted to start off with, but we are interested in getting to some point into perennial planting. So we want to be able to put something down that won't have to be replanted every year. Those kind of plantings are more expensive initially, and they do require some cultivation for the first couple of years, but afterwards they can become pretty self-sustaining. So we know that we're going to continue to use sunflowers in the immediate future, but we're already researching different seed mixes to improve this program in the future and make it something that's self-sustaining.
Jocelyn, is there any evidence at this point, or is it too soon, for that planting these sunflowers has helped the honeybee population?
Yeah, it would really be too soon to be able to tell, but we are able to at least see that they are a popular food source just by stopping by those plantings. When we've been out checking out the success of the plants, it's hard to find a flower head that doesn't have a honeybee or two on it. So that we know just from seeing it that it's a popular food source. Of course, it would probably take several years worth of research to be able to tell whether or not our efforts are directly boosting the honeybee population.
And I'm sure for the public, it's just they're pretty, you know, a nice a splash of color. So you're helping pollinators, but you're also brightening the roadside.
Absolutely. The success from a public perception was more than what I think any of us expected to see from this. Nearly all of the feedback that we got last year and this year was really popular. So the two locations in Saginaw and Bay County where sunflowers are planted are on loop ramps for interchanges. So they're really visible for people, that are commuting on a daily basis. The location in Isabella County is located actually in a highway median. So we had comments from daily motorists that said, you know, they were just driving along back and forth morning and night on their commute, noticing that something was coming up. And they said, you know, it looked intentional. It didn't look like it was weeds that were coming up, but nobody knew. And sunflowers, they kind of tend to come out of nowhere as far as, you know, when they flower. So people were just driving along one day and all of a sudden it's a yellow flower head instead. And they were, you know, surprised and happy. And to be perfectly honest, we've had some people say if we could plant sunflowers along all of our right of way, that we would see a reduction in road rage and things like that, because it's just hard to be angry when you see something like that. And certainly that's not something that's feasible from a cost or maintenance perspective, but it is good to know that the efforts were appreciated, not just by honeybees, but also by our motorists.
Jocelyn Hall is with MDOT's Bay Region, where they're planting sunflowers, brightening life for motorists, and also supporting pollinator insects like our honeybees. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us, Jocelyn.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Coming up, is teacher burnout contagious?
If you're surrounded by people who are experiencing burnout, you are likely to increase in your burnout.
That's in 10 minutes here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. She wants to wrestle with the University of Michigan Dearborn men's team. But the rules of the National Collegiate Wrestling Association are women wrestle women, men wrestle men in practice and competition. And now Marina Gucher has the ACLU on her side as she fights to compete with the men. With us now is Marina Gucher, who's a wrestler at the University of Michigan Dearborn, and Bonsitu Kataba, a staff attorney with the ACLU of Michigan. Marina, why are you trying to get on the men's team?
So with NCAA, there's not an equal opportunities for men and female in wrestling, which means that throughout the season, the guys have the ability to compete multiple times. And since I'm only technically allowed to wrestle females, I can still be on the team, but I have to be benched and can't wrestle until nationals. So basically, even though there's a whole bunch of guys in my area to wrestle, I have to sit around and I can only compete the one time, which is nationals. So I'm kind of fighting for like equal opportunities. So that's why I want to be able to wrestle guys, just because I want to be able to wrestle. It doesn't really matter if it's a guy or a girl.
And is there a women's team, wrestling team at U of M Dearborn?
Yes, but I am the only one.
So you're it?
Yes.
How long have you wrestled, Marina?
I started wrestling when I was 5 years old.
And did you wrestle against boys in high school or in grade school?
Yes. I've been wrestling guys since I was five, so through elementary school, middle school, and high school. And then when I got to college, that's when they said, you can't anymore. So.
All right. Let me turn to you, Bonsitu Kataba. The ACLU has joined with the National Women's Law Center and the Women's Sports Foundation and sent off a letter to the National Collegiate Wrestling Association. So what's in the letter? What are you asking for on behalf of Marina?
The letter that we sent to the National Collegiate Wrestling Association essentially outlines Marina's story and highlights that she is a national championship wrestler, but because there are no other women on the U of M Dearborn team and actually no other women wrestlers in the Great Lakes Conference in which her team competes in, she is precluded from wrestling during the regular season and only has one opportunity at the end of the year to compete. And under the law is clear that women should be given equal opportunities to participate in athletics, including contact sports like wrestling, even if there are no women's teams. So the letter goes through and highlights what NCAA's policies are, like you stated, women wrestle women, men wrestle men, period, and how that actually deprives many women across that athletic association of an opportunity to compete on the same playing field as their male counterparts.
What's happening elsewhere in the country, let's say in other divisions? What's the NCAA's position on this?
The NCAA rules of competition say that they must abide by the NCAA rules of competition. And we know from history that the NCAA allows women to compete on certain male wrestling teams. There are examples across the country, women who have competed on their NCAA Division I, Division II teams, who have gone on to win national championships, compete at the Olympics. And Patricia Miranda is actually one of the greatest examples of this. She competed on Stanford's NCAA wrestling team in 2001 and was the only female on that team, went on to compete against several male wrestlers, won competitions against those wrestlers, and then went on to be the first woman to win an Olympic medal in the 2004 Games.
Marina, what are you hearing from the U of M Dearborn men's wrestling team, from the coach and from the athletes on that team?
My coach and my teammates are all very supportive, and all of them just want to see me wrestle. None of them seem to care if I'm a female, and they all agree that I should be able to wrestle.
Is this basically about just getting a chance to wrestle and compete any way you can, or is it about making a point of being able to be on a man's team? I guess I'm asking, if U of M Dearborn had other women who were wrestling and had a women's team that wasn't just you, would you be okay with being on that team, or would you still be pressing to be on the men's team?
The main thing I'm trying to stress is just equal opportunities. So I'm trying to join the men's team, and I'm trying to have the opportunity to wrestle men because there's no girls in our area. For instance, if there were a lot of girls' teams to wrestle, and if there was a lot of girls to wrestle, and if it was the kind of the same amount of people, guys and girls, then I wouldn't have this problem because I would actually have people to wrestle.
Bone Situ, is there a potential lawsuit here?
Well, we are very hopeful that we can open a dialogue with the NCAA to shed some light on their rules, and hopefully they can see by Marina's story and all the support behind her that a rule change needs to happen. But we're still developing all the options.
And I know the letter has just been sent, so you are waiting for a response, or have you gotten something?
We haven't had a response from the NCAA yet, but we are asking for a response by November 7th.
Marina Gutcher, trying to get on the men's wrestling team at the University of Michigan Dearborn, and staff attorney with the Michigan ACLU, Bone Situ Kataba. Thank you so much to both of you for speaking with us.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you.
We actually did reach out to the National Collegiate Wrestling Association based in Dallas and heard back. Executive Director Jim Junta sent us this response, and I quote, "The core mission of the NCAA is to expand collegiate wrestling opportunities for all participants. The NCAA encourages and supports wrestling programs developed through university sports club departments so that more student athletes may pursue their athletic, academic, and leadership goals. The NCAA provides equal opportunities for men and women to excel and be awarded All-American honors and encourages universities to develop and grow both men's and women's programs. The NCAA is a privately held association that promotes the sport of amateur wrestling at all levels. It receives no state or federal money and is principally composed of volunteers, mostly wrestling enthusiasts, coaches, and former wrestlers. The NCAA supports both its men's and women's divisions equally and is the only governing body that offers equal opportunity to both men and women to compete in wrestling at the college level. We do wish that we had been afforded time to respond to the ACLU's letter before its distribution to the media. Having championed women in wrestling since before forming the women's division in 2006, the NCAA is proud of the strength, growth, and diversity of its women's programs and takes seriously charges of discrimination." Once again, that statement comes from Jim Junta, Executive Director of the National Collegiate Wrestling Association. How do we keep eager young teachers eager and keep them in the profession? The future of our children's education rests on that answer. One big way is to keep young teachers in the profession and prevent burnout. Michigan State University professor Ken Frank and his colleagues have just come out with a research paper on teacher burnout. He co-authored the study with Jihun Kim, an MSU doctoral student, and Peter Youngs, a former MSU scholar. Ken, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
What got you and the team looking at the burnout question?
Well, for Jihun, who was the first author on the paper, she was a teacher for a number of years, and she suffered some of the effects of burnout just by virtue of being in normal teaching activities. And for myself, I've been studying schools as organizations for a long time and have been very worried about the commitment and engagement and coordination among teachers and the factors that affect that commitment.
So what questions were you hoping to answer in this study?
Well, we wanted to learn how schools as organizations affected burnout of teachers. In particular, is it the school as a whole that could have an effect on a teacher? Or is it the small number of people that they interact with on a daily basis? And we especially were focusing on early career teachers in the first few years of teaching.
So what'd you find?
Well, we found that both the localized network, the people you interact with on a day-to-day basis, affected your burnout. If you're surrounded by people who are experiencing burnout, you are likely to increase in your burnout. But also the school as an organization, if in general the people in your building are experiencing burnout, then that will affect you as well. And in the end, actually, the organizational effects were stronger than the immediate local network. The people you just are who are around, who you don't necessarily interact day to day, can have important effects on how you perceive your job.
So it really sounds like it's kind of starts from the top and works its way right down to the newest teacher.
Yeah. And that means that what goes on at the school as a whole can pervade the whole school.
So what would be some of the characteristics of a bad organizational structure at a school, Ken?
Okay, so to be clear, that's a little bit beyond this particular study, but it's certainly part of a lot of the work that I do in general about schools as organizations. So one concern that I have about schools is when they try to do too many things too quickly or one on top of one another. And what that does is it ultimately pits teachers against each other. They're not available to help each other and sustain a long-term commitment to a particular innovation or reform. And when you have that, then the teachers forget to talk to each other. It becomes harder for them to talk to each other harder for them to coordinate. And that then isolates the teacher, and that can lead to burnout.
Boy, that breaks down. And I think you could pretty well apply that to many organizations, many workplaces.
Yeah, a lot of the work that I've done and Peter Youngs has done in this area, who's also a co-author, concern organization culture in general. I've studied the Nature Conservancy and other non-governmental organizations. I've also done studies in business realms and things like that.
Let's circle back to teachers. It would seem, I think, pretty obvious that a teacher who is burned out isn't going to be giving his or her best in the classroom. Can you take us more deeply into that? I mean, just how does teacher burnout, how can it impact student learning and test scores?
First, there is, of course, just the level of commitment. It's very hard to sustain your level of commitment. That might mean extra things you do after the school day, or it just might be the way you engage students during the school day, and that stuff can spill over onto the students. And then beyond that, if you're burned out and just manage to maintain your professionalism in spite of it, you still might not be very invested in the people around you, and they might not invest in you. And so then you could become isolated, and even if you were doing a decent job, you would have a hard time coordinating and investing in the broader project of the school. And again, the students can suffer from that because, just imagine a 7-year-old learning from a teacher reading approach 1 year, and then the next year getting an entirely different approach from a teacher who is not well integrated into the school. That could be very challenging for a young kid.
And there's something related to teacher evaluation. You call it the Magic Johnson effect. What do you mean by that?
So, for very Michigan specific, Magic Johnson scored 17 one-points a game when he was at Michigan State, which was good, but not great. Not in the top 10 of all-time Michigan State. But he, his teammates and coaches and opponents all knew the contribution he was making. And when we just do individual teacher value-added scores, we probably miss the Magic Johnson effect. That's like their points per game, but we lose the team effort and the whole focus of the team orientation.
What do you feel the big takeaway is from your research? Let's start with the young teachers, with the newcomers to the profession.
They should be sensitive to the organizations in which they're working, the schools in which they're working. They are not impervious to that. It's not the young teachers that I see for the most part are very dedicated. They really want to implement what they've learned in their training. And then to raise the awareness that they should be sensitive to how to choose and navigate the schools in which they're working. And mentoring can help. Getting support from administrators can help. So that would be for the young teacher, and to know that these are complex, serious things, that they're not the only ones that could be feeling at times frustrated or the challenges of having lots of pressures on them from different directions.
And then let's flip that. What should veteran teachers and school administrators take from what you've discovered?
School administrators and the veteran teachers, I think, need to be sensitive to the implications of all of the decisions that they take for the school culture as a whole, because that school culture will then permeate to many people in the school that they might not expect. So that would apply to, well, you're going to adopt a new curriculum, or you're going to redo the school schedule, and you might think that the curriculum is really good from a cognitive perspective, or the school schedule really fits from the community perspective, which could be totally legitimate. But you should also think about what would the implications be for the organizational culture of the school. Will this make it easier for people to work together, to get along? How will it affect the beginning teachers who are entering into your school if you have a new curriculum that they're not trained in and maybe have a hard time finding help to support to implement? That sort of thing. So I think it could affect a lot of the decisions that people make day to day, that they don't think first how will it affect the organizational culture, but we'd want that to be on the radar.
What about policymakers? We've got a lot of policy being handed down here in our state from folks in Lansing. Do this, don't do this. How is that impacting our teachers, and what should they take from what you found?
When policymakers create a lot of short-term urgencies for schools, that can be very challenging for schools as organizational cultures, because it takes schools' time, the people in the schools' time, to coordinate and respond to new demands or requests. And so when there are too many of those, that can become very challenging for a school. And then in particular, I'm quite sensitive to the use of test scores to evaluate particular teachers. I totally understand that schools need to be accountable, and test scores are a part of that, but I think that should apply at the school level. When those pressures are applied to individual teachers, it creates a lot of pressure for teachers to perform independently well and to do whatever they need to do to perform that way, and that cuts them off from each other. And when you start cutting them off from each other, that's when they start, they can lose their motivation, they can lose their commitment to the school, and that can create problems down the way.
Ken, what's at stake? Why are these important questions right now?
Well, we lose a fair number of beginning teachers, early career teachers. The estimates might range from 15 to 20% over the first 3 or 4 years of teaching. And those are not necessarily teachers that did not get tenure. Those are teachers who are leaving teaching voluntarily. And many of them will report that their working conditions are better in their new jobs than in their old. So we are losing, as a society, we are losing people we have trained and who were interested and committed to the profession. So and we do not have a surplus of teachers. We are constantly looking for new teachers. And also we are losing the newly trained teachers. So as colleges of education, schools of education try to train teachers, give them new ideas, we're losing a lot of that recent training. So that's from the sort of societal perspective, and obviously from the beginning career teacher's perspective. Well, they've invested in a profession and now they're redirecting, and there are enormous costs to that, both in terms of their identity, but financial, et cetera. And from the school's perspective, well, they recruited and hired a new teacher, maybe invested in some professional development, And now they've lost that teacher. And that can actually create a very negative cycle if you start to lose a lot of teachers like that.
A lot of brain power and a lot of energy being siphoned away.
Yes.
Ken Frank is a foundational professor of sociometrics at Michigan State University. Ken, thank you so much for sharing your research with us.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, and Tyler Scott. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.